So, okay, it is August 18th. It's the 19th, isn't it? It's August 18th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Jeff Solomon of Ramius. Mr. Solomon, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer. With me are some other FCIC colleagues. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. That statute tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report to Congress and the President by the 15th of December of this year, which we hope to do. That statute also tells us to look at various things, including any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. It also tells us to look at systemically important institutions and the issue of too big to fail in general. That is why we are looking at Lehman Brothers. That is part of that investigation in terms of too big to fail, systemically important institutions. We have been contacting and interviewing many different types of Lehman counterparties, including hedge funds. And that is why we decided to call Ramius, and Mr. Lippman was nice enough to identify you as a person that could help us out in that regard. So we'd like to talk. What I'd like to do first is, have you, I guess, just generally describe for us what Ramius is and what its various business relationships with Lehman was, and then we'll move on from there.
Okay. So Ramius is an alternative investment manager, which is a euphemism for hedge fund.
Okay.
We had a prime brokerage relationship with Lehman primarily. We also cleared the securities lending business through Lehman Brothers at the time, so we had counterparty risk limits for securities loans as well. That was our primary point at which we interfaced with Lehman.
Okay, and how long have you had a business relationship with Lehman?
First of all, a number of us were originally Lehman employees. I actually had I worked for Lehman for 2 years, when it was Shearson Lehman Hutton.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of us go back a long way with Lehman Brothers. We really didn't have much. We didn't really start to have much of a prime brokerage relationship with Lehman until like 2001, somewhere in that general vicinity.
Okay.
And they became over the time they became probably one of our lead prime brokers. I mean, they were one of the very first firms to really establish a client relationship format that allowed us to go across platform at Lehman. We actually helped them to design that. It was really one of it was at the forefront of trying to figure out how to cover hedge funds, which was a new thing. They really developed this client relationship group that allowed us to really transcend all the various business units at Lehman. And so we had a pretty deep relationship with them of all of our prime brokers. The three prime brokers, that we had a very, very deep relationship with Lehman Brothers.
Okay.
So, the one thing I would say, and I agree obviously with everything Jeff said, but one thing I wanted to reiterate from the conversation we had the other day is that Lehman was a significant prime broker relationship for us, but we did have other significant prime broker relationships. So, in 2008, when things blew up, while we had a significant amount of assets with Lehman, compared to the overall fund assets we managed, it was one of a number of prime broker relationships, and it was not the situation where we had substantially all of our assets prime brokered there.
Can you give us an idea of what the size of your overall prime brokerage was, and then the how much in each of the three?
I think it was around. Let me think about this. If I look at total AUM, it's easier for me to think about it in terms of total AUM because that's kind of the way we looked at it. It was less than 5% of the equity. Less than 5% was at Lehman.
Okay.
So that had come down pretty significantly post Bear Stearns. So I think going into the year 2008, we were I want to say it's probably closer to like 20%, 20-25%. So we had three big relationships at that point in time: Lehman, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman. And Goldman was always our biggest. I would say they were all sort of neck and neck, but but the three of them were kind of, I would say pretty evenly distributed.
Okay, and then so from in the March 08 Bear Stearns time frame, you still got 20-25% of your AUM at Lehman and the other 75-80% at Morgan and Goldman?
There were some assets that are kept. We had like smaller prime brokers for specialty business, so it wasn't, those three didn't add to 100%. Those three probably added up to 80-85%. Again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I'm cuffing it based on what I remember at the time.
Right.
To be clear, but I would say clearly those three were our leads. Clearly, they were all in the 20-30% range, somewhere in that vicinity at various points of time. Post Bear, we brought down the Lehman exposure to in September it was about a little more than 5%.
And was that just a gradual wind down from March to September or something else?
I think we had worked pretty carefully with the guys at Lehman. We had a pretty significant convert business there, and they had actually given us a heads up to say that that converts as an asset class, convertible bonds and preferreds in particular, were not going to be accepted at the Fed window. And that they actually called us to sort of give us, sort of a heads up. They were one of the first firms to call us to give us a heads up and let us know that that was likely to be the case. So we actually moved into action, actually began to sell our converts into a pretty significant rally in April and May. And when we sold those converts down, when we sold down, we paid down debit balances. So I don't think it was so much about a function of moving our assets away from Lehman Brothers, although we did in certain cases. It was more a function of the fact that their primary asset class that we were housing with them, we decided to exit.
Okay. So it wasn't a counterparty-specific thing. It was an instrument thing.
Well, I think it was both. There had been discussion post-Bear who's the next one to go. And, it wasn't a mystery that it was Lehman. So, we weren't adding balances at Lehman, and we weren't shifting balances to Lehman. So I think, we had a stated objective that we were going to be selling down positions and de-risking the portfolios anyway, and that we weren't going to be adding risk at Lehman specifically. In other words, it wasn't a stated objective of ours.
Mm-hmm. Were you reducing exposure to either Goldman or Morgan?
Not specifically. We were more concerned about Lehman than Goldman or Morgan Stanley, though I will tell you, in my experiences post-September 12th, 15th, mm-hmm. whatever day it was.
15th was the Monday of the bankruptcy filing.
Yeah. I don't think it would have much mattered who we'd have had done business with.
Right.
I think we were all staring into the abyss. I can tell you, at some other point in time, you want to talk about Lehman today, at some other time I'll tell you about what Morgan Stanley did to us.
I gave them a little bit of a flavor for it the other day.
Yeah.
I don't think this is a Lehman specific thing. I think we were all staring into the abyss. We tried to move some balances from Goldman Sachs, and they threatened us in a pretty significant way, too, after September 12th.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody was rolling on the edge there.
Right. So tell me, I understand, and I've heard from other folks that once Bear went down, everybody knew there was sort of a pecking order, and folks sort of thought that Lehman was the next most vulnerable investment bank. Why did you think that?
Oh gosh, I think it's just a function of size of balance sheet and. I think it's more, again, a function of size of balance sheet. And look, the shorts were, the guys who had short positions, I was at the Ira Stone conference when David Einhorn made his famous pitch
right.
about why Lehman was bankrupt. And, I didn't agree with his analysis. I had already been through the Lehman balance sheet a number of times. I didn't agree with it, but I did understand that there was a bigger risk in that balance sheet than in the other firms. And so, I just thought it was prudent for us to be taking our exposure down. I didn't think that Lehman would go bankrupt, but I could see that, certain triggers in some of our term funding agreements that had to do with where Lehman CDS was likely to trade. The CDS market was a pretty good barometer for who was likely to fall next. And when those gapped out, I wanted to be in a position where I knew they could immediately sort of start to call our funding lines into place. So we were bringing down risk, not just because we were worried about Lehman specifically, but because we were concerned that if we didn't delever the books and didn't delever the portfolio, that someday somebody was going to tell us we had to. And certainly I was adamant in those days, and I still am adamant, I want to make sure I'm in control of when I get to sell things. So we actually, even during that period, we never had a margin call that we couldn't meet. And that was, I think, a pretty critical thing for us. So this is, I think, a function of us just trying to think forward and not be overly reliant on overnight funding from counterparties in general that we thought might someday come and pull our lines.
So, go ahead.
This is sort of a background, and I don't generally trumpet this. So it's I spent a fair amount of time post crash. I was invited to go on the Committee for Capital Markets Regulation as a member of the this subcommittee on this technical advisory group that wrote a pretty substantial paper on the global financial crisis and a plan for regulatory reform. This is Glenn Hubbard and Hal Scott and those guys. I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it, but it's not, and again, I think it's less about me and more about the fact that they got a lot of people together who saw this from various angles and put together a piece that really helped to try and frame the regulatory discussion post-crash for how we can not just, you know, prohibit this or prevent this from happening in the future, but how to rethink the regulatory framework in order to address, you know, systemic risk and global financial crisis. So you guys, if you haven't had a chance to read it, I'm happy to, you know, happy to email it to you because there's a lot of stuff in there you should probably, you know, think about.
Oh, that'd be great, actually. I appreciate that. I personally haven't read it. I suspect somebody here has. And when I say here, I don't mean in the conference room, but I mean at the FCIC, as I get looks from people across the table from me. So tell me then, you know, and well, actually, before I continue on there, explain to me your securities lending business with Lehman.
We were in the securities lending business with our broker dealer, Remia Securities, and we were clearing through. I think it was we were clearing through a Lehman's DTC number. So Lehman was our sponsor at DTC, and we were self clearing, but we were using their DTC, and they were guaranteeing our. They gave us our own DTC number so that we could clear through those guys.
So then what was your, I mean, trust me, I'm not a street guy, a hedge fund guy by any means. Explain to me what kind of exposure you have to Lehman through that business.
Well, it's twofold. One is, you know, they're guaranteeing the settlement and delivery of our securities loans in cash. So the way a securities lending market works is, you know, we may be borrowing securities from a counterparty and lending them to another counterparty, and with every borrow that you have in the security, there is a cash movement that's usually equal to or greater than the notional value of the securities you're borrowing or lending. So the balance, so that's what they refer to as a match book. It's securities borrowed on one side, securities lent on the other side, but you really have matching cash received from one counterparty and an obligation to pay back another party. So it's really four transactions. Two transactions with four entries. So those guys, all of those trades were clearing through Lehman's DTC number. Now, everyone knew it was our number, so in fact, if we had failed to deliver, the defunct Lehman entity would have had to put up for us. We never failed to deliver. But the risk we had was that Lehman was actually a securities lending counterparty for us in addition to clearing and settling our trades. So we had lent securities in and borrowed securities from Lehman Brothers. And either if we were borrowing from Lehman, we lent them to somebody else, and if we were lending to Lehman, we had borrowed them from somebody else. And in the days just after the broker-dealer in the U.S. closed, two things. One, we couldn't get the securities that we lent to them back, so we had to go into the market, buy the securities, and deliver them back to the counterparty. That was one risk. Two, we had to the extent that they owed us cash because we borrowed from them and posted cash collateral there, we had to figure out a way to get the cash collateral back by essentially trying to deliver securities back to Lehman Brothers in order to generate cash. Really, what we ended up doing at that point in time is we ended up selling out the securities and generating enough cash in the sale to return the cash to the...
To say we don't have an obligation to return the securities back to Lehman. Instead, we're going to keep the cash that we generated from the sale. To the extent there was a shortfall, we have a claim against Lehman for the delta.
That's right.
And just to, you know...
For the difference.
And just to clarify what Jeff is saying, you know, this is all done under a... you know, master security lending agreement, which is a standardized agreement that, you know, a lot of people operate under.
Yeah, it's the way the whole securities lending business works. I mean, we weren't any different than any other securities lender, and I don't think this experience was any different than any other person who had exposure to Lehman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other thing that I would say, you know, again, following up on a conversation we had the other day, is that I think this is probably one of the two types of relationships, the other being, you know, repurchase agreements, which explain what happened to all the securities that have been re-hypothecated.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, you know, I think they were governed, they're probably either, you know, listed and sold under a repurchase agreement or potentially lent out under a securities lending agreement. And when Lehman went insolvent, the counterparties who were holding on to those securities then exercised their rights under the, you know, relevant agreement and basically sold those securities and, you know, use the cash to offset obligations to or from Lehman, and then had, you know, stub claims for any difference in value.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the securities lending business, where Lehman was your counterparty for either borrowing or lending securities, were you guys reducing that exposure at all?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, not really, because, you know, that's a business that, you know, I mean, yes, you have counterparty risk, but the I was mostly concerned about funding risk. I was really worried that Lehman was just, you know, because they were going to be squeezed, they were going to have to cut off our funding. I really wasn't thinking about Lehman as a bankrupt entity. We did take our securities lending business down in general, so we didn't have the same size, but I really wasn't worried about whether or not Lehman, we were ever going to be facing a point in time in which we wouldn't be able to wind that down. Because understand, the securities lending business, arguably, you can wind that down tomorrow. Right? If you're in the business today and you return all the loans, and all the borrows, you can shut it down overnight. It's not a business where there's stickiness to it.
Yeah, I think the one thing, you know, Jeff, you know, let me know if you feel differently, but I think one of the other things that distinguishes, you know, your relationship with one counterparty versus another from a securities lending standpoint is the type of securities that your counterparty has access to lend to you. And I think one of the things that we found, you know, one of the things that I think was the case with Lehman is that they were, in some circumstances, able to lend us securities that we might not have been able to borrow from other counterparties, which meant that, you know, if we wanted to have access to these securities in order to borrow them, you know, in some instances we really had to do it with Lehman because we might not have been able to find those securities to borrow with some of our other counterparties.
What kind of securities were those?
Equities.
I'm sorry?
Just equities.
Well, then why couldn't you get them from some other counterparty? They're just equities.
Well, that's the whole securities lending business, right? I know somebody who's willing to lend me 100,000 shares of XYZ, so I can borrow that. Not everybody knows who that is. Like, I know that Owen is willing to lend it to me, but I don't really have a relationship with Michael, so I have no idea whether or not he's willing to lend it or not.
Oh, so it wasn't the securities per se, it was just the relationship with Lehman.
No, like, no. I could be borrowing from Morgan Stanley and lending to Goldman Sachs, and just, that might be a trade that I've on three different times. Mm-hmm. Somebody at Goldman Sachs needed to borrow 100,000 shares of XYZ, they couldn't get it because they didn't have access to it. They might call us and say, can you find 100,000 shares of XYZ? We might actually know where to go to get it. And
okay.
We can get it, borrow it, and lend it to them.
Okay, I see.
That's what happens. I mean, the whole securities lending business, we could spend, you know, days on that. But the bottom line is, there was one other piece of it that was really, I think, important, and that is you have to post variance margin every day. So you don't settle and you don't close out your trades every night in the securities lending business like with a repo book. You don't do that. You basically just have to post variation margin. So at the end of the day, you net settle. Either Lehman Brothers owes you money or you owe Lehman Brothers money, cash. Just a cash movement, not earnings. Either you're expected to post collateral places, I maybe expected to post, you know, $10 million to Morgan Stanley, but you know, between my, I'm going to collect $10 million from Goldman and Morgan because just based on the movement of securities prices during the course of the day. What really hurt us potentially, and this is where we felt like we had some systemic, some serious risk is, it was unclear to us whether or not Lehman was going to continue to net settle. Mm-hmm. So if we were getting margin called at, you know, name the broker, name the counterparty, you know, when we had, you know, hundreds of them that we were going to have to settle with each night, and then we put in for Lehman to net settle against us, to pay us cash, and it didn't, well, that's a pretty open-ended exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, or in the days, I don't know why this happened or how it happened, I'm just thankful that it did happen. In the days post the bankruptcy, they continued to be a participant in CNS, which is the continuous net settlement system, and they continued to post margin.
Well, they did that probably until the 19th.
I don't know what they did.
Yeah.
But it gave us enough time to unwind the entire book and net settle it out. So we needed like 2 or 3 days to unwind.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fortunate.
Yeah, no, we were like, I mean, you want to talk about it. So when we sat down, you know, and on the night of the night of the 14th.
That would be Sunday night.
Yeah. And we made the hit list of stuff that could cart us out the next day. This one was at the top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
This one could have been a potential run on the firm.
Right, right.
And so, because this was a Ramius time had a little more than $500 million worth of equity in it,
mm-hmm.
and our match book was like maybe $750 million to $800 million, so not big. I mean, some people were running match books that could have been like, you know, 10 times that amount, or like 5 times that amount, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't running a book that was that big at the time. We never really felt comfortable running a matchbook 5-to-1 on equity. But what we were able to do was, cauterize that risk pretty quickly so that we weren't going to blow through our equity at the firm.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big one for us.
Right. So understanding that beginning in March of 2008, you guys start to reduce your exposure to Lehman in the prime brokerage account, and you go from ballpark 20-25% to about 5%. You had mentioned you were doing that because, one, everybody sort of knew Lehman was the next most vulnerable, and two, just because of the nature of the book, the convertible bonds that were in there, and you were starting to reduce that just anyway. At what point, if any point, did you guys think Lehman would fail or be allowed to fail?
During the course of that week, we had so many debates over whether or not Lehman would fail or not fail.
And when you say that week, I assume you mean the week leading up to the bankruptcy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, leading up to the administration, yes. I mean, we were sufficiently worried that we were debating it, and we took, you know, it's so funny, numbers are funny numbers. So if only 5% of your balances are at a number, you know, you're looking at the sum total of all your prime brokerage relationships, which we do, you know, I have somebody who looks at that every day, and you look at 5% and you say, okay, it's not that big until it goes to zero.
Right.
And then you realize how big 5% is. So I think I feel a lot differently about it today than I felt about it then. And so why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that because what you're getting is Jeff Solomon's post-revisionist with a lot of experience commentary, which is, I will tell you, decidedly different than Jeff Solomon's pre this experience. At the time, we looked at it, 5% didn't seem like it was such a big number, and the concept of the government letting Lehman go under in an uncontrolled way. So, big difference here, all right? I wasn't thinking that Lehman might not fail, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that if Lehman was going to fail, who would be stupid enough not to manage that wind down? Because every other time a brokerage firm had failed, like Drexel or anything else, it was managed so that people got their money back. I didn't have any directional exposure to Lehman. I just had counterparty exposure to Lehman. And at that, my counterparty exposure was very minimal relative to the size of our overall firm.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally would have had to not be at Lehman Brothers or engaged with Lehman Brothers at all not to get hurt. And the thought of our doing that, given how deep our relationship was with that firm, was unthinkable. Because they had treated us incredibly well. They had been a really, your prime brokers, you know, can many times be a strategic vendor for you. They were a strategic vendor. They were in a lot of businesses with us. They helped us out a lot. We made a lot of money together, and we had deep relationships at the firm. So when you look at the sum total of all of those, plus the fact that we figured that if we had just seen Fannie and Freddie, mm-hmm. and what the federal government did with Fannie and Freddie, you know, how they sort of, they punished the equity, but they preserved the debt. And right. We're like, there's no way that you can be stupid enough to let an interconnected firm like Lehman Brothers go under. If it's going to go under, they're going to at least put it into conservatorship and return the assets in an orderly fashion. That's what they're going to do, if they're going to do anything.
I think, two things I think that I said the other day. I think additional points here. Number one, I think there was also a sense here that we didn't want to be, for the reasons that Jeff described, and maybe some other reasons, we didn't want to be an accelerant to a run on the bank at Lehman. And then the second thing I would say is that I think we probably felt that because of the fact that most of our exposure to Lehman was the nature of securities, and we had relatively small exposure in terms of derivatives, I think we probably felt that from a securities perspective that the, protections afforded under 15c3, for the broker-dealer, we thought would, if there was some kind of failure, that we'd have some protection there as well. So I think those two things also colored in part how we were thinking about Lehman in the week leading up to the insolvency.
Mm-hmm.
I also think one of the things I said to you the other day is that, frankly, even if we concluded during that week that we should move our balances out of Lehman, A, I don't know that we would have been able to because they just might not have done it.
Well, we tried.
Yeah, and B.
We tried. By Thursday, we were like, okay, this is not going to be pretty. So, and now I'm a little bit worried that I'm not exactly sure how this whole thing is going to play off. So we were actually trying to lay off some of our securities lending risk on Thursday, and we were trying to lay it off to Morgan Stanley, who, interestingly enough, was like, we'll take it, we'll take it, we'll take it, we'll take it, we'll not take it. They were like, we'll take it, we'll help you, we'll take it. Oh, we're not taking anything. Right?
When does the we're not taking anything occur?
Over the weekend.
Oh, okay. So they take everything through close of business September 12th.
Well, they kept saying they would take it.
Oh.
Every time you go to try to put it to them, it wasn't happening. And then, the guy I was talking to was like, I'm not taking it. The thing that crushes me most here is that look, it's highly emotional, okay? So, I've played this script over in my head 1,000 times. Should we have done something differently? What did we miss? Did we have the right discussions internally? And I've come away each time thinking that objectively, because I've had to face the firing squad of investors and clients who demanded to know what our process was. Each time I come away with the thought here that we did, everything that we could have or should have done short of firing Lehman as a prime broker, which I just don't think was on our radar screen. We took all our balances and we did everything we could do.
Mm-hmm.
But firing Lehman was not on our radar screen. Now, let me take it in a slightly different direction. If that's okay with you.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I spent the entire weekend, I can remember sitting outside. It was my daughter's birthday on the 12th on Friday. My whole family's inside celebrating my daughter's birthday, and I'm outside on the phone with all the Lehman guys on Friday night trying to make heads or tails about whether or not that Lehman was actually going to fail. And it was abundantly unclear, even from the Lehman guys, that that was going to happen. You know, all of our relationships, is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? It's not going to happen. Don't worry. It's not going to happen. It might happen. Well, we should probably prepare. What if it does happen? At that point, I started getting calls from the Fed. We have a deep relationship with the Federal Reserve Board. Still do have a pretty good relationship, though our primary contact person has moved on. But during this crisis, during the Bear Stearns situation, all during the crisis, my partner Peter Cohen and I spent a fair amount of time on the phone with the Federal Reserve Board.
Who there?
They had a hedge fund outreach program,
mm-hmm.
and we spent time with a lot of people there. We had a primary contact person, but you know, I was in front of the Fed. Going back as far as December of 2007, you know, basically right after the temporary auction format was put into place, and they did like a $20 billion temporary auction format, and I had breakfast that day. I had lunch that day down there with Bill Dudley's people, and they said, you know, what do you think? And I'm like, what do I think? I think he came up like a day late, a dollar short. And they're like, well, why? And I'm like, well, I can think of like three people that need $100 billion. And they're like, get out. And I'm like, no. I can think about, you know, and I wasn't thinking Lehman at that time. I was thinking like the big banks, like Citi and Merrill and places like that that might need that kind of funding, you know, for that kind of stuff. So I've been engaged with the Fed now for 9 months on this issue, mm-hmm. on these issues, relating to the crisis. During the Bear Stearns, when Bear Stearns tapped the window, that Friday, Jackson Hole, ironically enough, with the Lehman Prime Brokerage team, and I actually got the call about Bear Stearns tapping the window,
mm-hmm.
While the Lehman funding matrix was on the slideshow. Like, they had a slideshow, the Lehman funding matrix was up on the screen. I mean, you know, so senior treasury people from Lehman talking about how bulletproof their balance sheet was and how bulletproof their funding matrix was. And I'm getting a call that Bear Stearns tapped the window.
Mm-hmm.
So I then proceeded to spend the better part of that day when I wasn't skiing on the phone with our Fed Reserve, with our Fed people, having conference calls with New York and Washington about what would happen in the CDS market, what would happen in the counterparty markets if they let Bear Stearns fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent a fair amount of time with them. I didn't have any skin in that game. I had no dog in that fight because I had no exposure to Bear Stearns, and I was providing, I thought, pretty good insight as to what would happen if an interconnected party like Bear Stearns failed. So that they solved that problem by Sunday night, and the world goes on, though I would say chastened, is that the right word, by the events of that weekend. So people are bringing down their exposures now pretty significantly because that was a near miss. All right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the phone with the same people during the weekend with Lehman. Only like four times as many of them. Like, now I'm having conference calls, six people here in New York, six, seven people in D.C. It's clear to me that there is a cadre of people who believe that Lehman should be allowed to fail, and a cadre of people who believe that Lehman, we need to do whatever we can do to save face here and do this in an orderly fashion. And I could tell by the questions I was being asked by these various groups which group I was talking to. And I must have done, I don't want to overstate it, a half a dozen calls with the Fed that weekend between Saturday and Sunday. In each group of people asked me what would happen if Lehman failed in some form or another. And I had a list. By the time I got to the sixth call, I was pretty proficient at it. I had a list of 10 or 11 or 12 things that, you know, might happen if Lehman failed as a counterparty. Securities lending was at the top of our list.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a whole host of other ones that included CDS, swap settlement, all these unsecured, you know, settlements and claims, net security settlements, so buys and sells, trades that weren't cleared yet, all of these things that I knew that people would be like wondering, where do I stand on Monday morning?
Right.
And, but I was really clear about this, and I don't say this to be like I was some seer or that I was that prescient. I just wanted to be clear that you may have conversations with people just like me, and I may be able to give you the 10 or 12 things that I think are likely to happen, but I promise you, it'll be the 13th thing that gets us if you let this fail. So you may be able to solve all the things that I'm talking about, and something will happen that none of us thought about.
I think, by the way, just following up on that point, one of the things that I don't think was on Jeff's list, but he can correct me if I'm wrong, and it's one of the things that, in my view, created a very complicated situation for liquidating Lehman, is the cross-jurisdictional disconnect resulting from the different insolvency of all the different jurisdictions. And that has created it's an understatement to say that it's created a lot of complexity here, but I'm not sure that was really on people's radar at the time. And that's been a very, very big issue.
That is the issue, right? So in all of my discussions, and it wasn't just them singing me, it was they had their own ideas and things like that. Nobody ever mentioned what would happen if London decided that the UK broker-dealer was insolvent. I never even imagined that another jurisdiction would actually move to bring down the walls around that regulated entity. It wasn't on my mind. And not only that, it wasn't on our radar screen until Monday morning when the news came out. And this is what gets me about this. As I was having my dialogues with everybody over that weekend, I kept saying, this isn't about protecting the equity. This isn't about protecting the unsecured bondholders. Flush them. If the frickin' thing is bankrupt and insolvent, they deserve to lose 100 cents on the dollar. This is about me as a client and the expectation that I'm dealing with a regulated U.S. broker-dealer where there are rules. And you want to flush the equity? Go right ahead, just like you did in Fannie and Freddie. Be my guest. But don't mess with me as a client, because I won't know where I stand tomorrow morning. And I'll tell you exactly what I'm going to do if I don't know where I stand tomorrow morning. I'm going to sell everything.
Right.
Because I just want my cash. And then I'm going to take that cash, and I'm going to wire it to the very safest place I can find. And then I'm going to call all my banks, and I'm going to borrow as much cash as I can possibly find. And I'm going to put that cash in the safest bank I can find. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm a pimple. Not even. I'm like a half pimple. A quarter pimple. I'm nothing. Okay? And so I'm telling you straight up what's going to happen in my shop. And you can take and multiply that by however many people there are that are like me, plus people that are similar to me and people that are sort of similar to me, and you know what's going to happen on Monday morning.
Right.
So please, whatever you do, don't let it go down uncontrolled. And I had that conversation, Peter had that conversation, and these were with, I think they were with some pretty, I can't list the people that were on the phone, but they were the policymakers, and they were gathering the information during that weekend to try and understand the ripple effect. And whether we were discounted or there were other people in the room that were having different conversations or had a different view or whatever, I don't know what happened. But somehow or not, and I can assure you, with everything that I've read subsequent and the people that I've talked to subsequent, that nobody had that in their mind. And the fact that 3 days later they turned around and bailed out AIG, and the fact that the fact that they were staring into the abyss at the complete meltdown of the money market, so much so that they had to create a program called TLGP. Which was the Term Loan Guarantee Program. The fact that the same people I was talking to on Sunday about please don't let Lehman go are calling me on Monday night while I'm driving home, because I wasn't really, I'm going home, I think, essentially to shower and come back. And they're asking me to think creatively about if they were to go up on the Hill Wednesday for a $700 billion bailout package, what should we tell them that we're going to do with that money? And I'm like, yesterday I was begging you not to let this thing go down, and today you're telling me you're going to spend $700 billion of taxpayer money to make sure that this financial system is solvent, and you have no idea what you're going to buy? Are you kidding me? Who's running the show here? Like, where is the people that are supposed to be watching this stuff? And has anybody heard anything I've said? I can't be the only guy out here. You know, and so like I get like that'd be great for the tape. I tend to be a little bit animated about this because it's if we had been oblivious and uninvolved and uninformed and quiet, and this happened to us, shame on us. Okay? Mm-hmm. But we weren't. I wasn't. We were all over this. And it was so unbelievable that the people who knew this let it happen in this fashion. You know, and like I said, this wasn't about whether or not an organization was too big to fail in the sense that there's a moral, like, hazard. That word fries me because it's the word that people use when they want to politicize the argument that we need to teach errant borrowers that they can't, that there's a moral hazard, and that you know, if you're making a loan, and you can't be bailed out on the repayment of that loan. I get that. That's the first rule of making a loan. Got it. That's not what we're talking about here. Those people, they should be flushed. But when you're dealing with a regulated entity, a broker-dealer, mind you, of that size, with that interconnection, that's why it's regulated. Mm-hmm. That's why there's the government involved in that part of the business. Otherwise, let's just live in a hedge fund world where it's unregulated, and there, near as I can tell, there's been no systemic risk. That's like the irony of this whole thing. The big crisis didn't happen in the hedge fund business, where everybody thought, it was going to happen because it's unregulated. It happened right under the regulators' noses in a highly regulated business
mm-hmm.
with multiple jurisdictions. Civil crime.
So let me take you back to the way you were managing the prime brokerage account and what Owen brought up when we talked to him, I think, earlier this week. All the days run together now. But you had mentioned, Owen, you had mentioned when we talked to you before that one of the reasons you didn't pull the prime brokerage account because you didn't want to trigger a run. But I thought I heard you say, Jeff, that you guys actually did try to pull the account towards the end of the week. Did I mishear you?
It's not really pulling the account. It's sort of like, okay, we move securities between prime brokers all the time. So pulling the account is like, pulling the account is like you don't pull an account. I mean, what you do is you never call a prime broker and say, I'm pulling my account. What you do is you start to move assets away in an orderly fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You basically, you ship assets from one firm to another. You ship cash from one firm to another.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, those balances go down significantly. So we weren't looking to pull the account. What we were doing was we were looking to, we were focused primarily on the securities lending business, and we were trying to move these things called put through trades. I mean, I don't want to go into the whole idea of put through trades in the securities business, the securities lending business. Lehman was sharing economics with us on put through trades. So if we could borrow things, or Rainy Securities could borrow things. And deliver them to Lehman, and Lehman would for our accounts, basically, for our fiduciary accounts. If we wanted to short a security, short a stock, and we could find the borrower ourselves, since our accounts didn't clear at our own broker dealer, they cleared at Lehman Brothers. We could basically borrow the security from another broker dealer and deliver it into Lehman Brothers at a decent rate.
Mm-hmm.
So Rainy Securities, in effect, was helping the funds here at Rainius to get better borrowing rates. That was one of the reasons why we had our own securities lending arm, so that we could make sure that the prime brokers weren't ripping our face off on securities lending fees. And Lehman was the only shop that was allowing us to put through those securities at a decent rate. The Morgan Stanley wasn't willing to do that, neither was Goldman Sachs. So I started to say, okay, you know what, we need to reduce our exposure to Lehman a little bit further. I want to take a look at the put-through trade, and I'd like to put them into Morgan Stanley. And even though Morgan Stanley's not going to give me the benefit of the financing rate that the Lehman is, we should probably just move that around, because if there is a problem here, that's one that I don't want to deal with. I don't want to deal with the securities lending business.
I think the point that I made the other day, and Jeff can comment on this if he didn't see it, but I do think that before sort of the right near the end, in terms of being right in the week before your days before the bankruptcy filing, I do think one of the things that we could have done is said, okay, let's take all of our positions there at Lehman, let's just move them to one or more of our other prime brokers. And I do think we were sensitive about doing that in kind of a large scale way, because that could have been an accelerant on the run on the bank if people start seeing large chunks of securities being moved out. Everyone says, okay, I better get my securities out of there. That itself could have created liquidity issues at Lehman, and until we were sort of a day before or a couple of days before the weekend, where it started to become clear that there was, some kind of impending bad event going on, we were given, we were just sensitive to not wanting to be an accelerant to that process. Mm-hmm.
So am I hearing both of you correctly then that, once you get later on in the week, to the 10th, 11th, or 12th or whatever, that then it was like, well, we may not want to be an accelerant, but we don't want to have our money tied up in bankruptcy or in administration in the UK either.
We're in a business system, so let me try to give you a corollary.
Okay.
Or an analogy. So, Let's say I think a stock is going to make. I'm long a stock, and I think it's going to make its earnings numbers. And as I get closer to the earnings date, I get a little bit less certain about whether or not I'm going to be hitting the numbers. I don't want to exit the position entirely, but I'm going to bring the position down because I'm just a little bit more uncertain about what the outcome is going to be. I'd say that's the way we were thinking. So it's not that we don't want to be we weren't so sure that we could move 100% of our assets. We had already taken them down significantly. Like I told you, 5% didn't seem like a big number at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we were sort of saying, okay, you know what? Let's take some of the things that would really let's reduce our exposure a little bit more here, just in case.
That's why we brought down derivatives exposure.
Yeah, we did. We moved our derivatives exposure for the most part. I had one trade left on.
But we moved a lot of it.
So how many? So at the time of the bankruptcy, you guys just had one derivative trade with Lehman?
No, we had more than that, but I had one that I remember.
But how far down did you bring that exposure?
I had very little exposure. That was an exposure where I bought volatility from Lehman Brothers. I actually got long volatility. I bought basically variance swaps on the VIX, and Lehman Brothers was my counterparty. So that was a great hedge that didn't really work.
But were you just doing new derivative trades with other broker dealers, or were you novating?
No, the whole novation thing was, it was hard. We were at closing them out. We had developed post bear a pretty good process of sweeping and making sure that we weren't leaving cash collateral against unsecured swap agreements. So we had very little in the way of exposure in the swaps market, either Lehman or anybody else. That wasn't the bulk of the issue here.
Okay.
The bulk of the issue for us is, I'm sure explained to you, is that we had a significant portion of our assets in the UK, and they had been rehypothecated, commingled, and shipped out to Lehman to finance their UK broker dealer.
Right. And now the fact that, I hear you guys talking about you didn't want to trigger a run, but if your account was down to 5%, was that still, I don't know what dollar amount that means in terms of Lehman as an overall business, but was that big enough? I don't know how things get around in the street that well, but would that have been seen?
I think it was sort of one of these things. Either, from a client standpoint, I'll see. you either had lingam exposure or you didn't. You either made the right call or you didn't. Like, you know, and we were on the wrong side of that ledger. The fact that we were smaller than we used to be didn't matter much. We still had it. So, you know, I don't know. It's sort of like people that got out of Madoff.
Right.
You know, great, if you took your exposure down from like, you know, 100% to 3%, still had Madoff exposure. Now that has a tail on it. We don't really have a tail on ours, but you know, sort of, I don't even think the number was so big. Now for us, I will tell you, it's the difference between living and dying. The guys who had much more significant exposure are dead. So our decision to move the funds and the firm's capital away from Lehman Brothers and reduce our exposure there is what saved us. I wouldn't be having, I'd be having this conversation with you, but I'd probably be wearing a different uniform.
So,
I'd probably be a little bit less like able to calm myself down after that last tirade.
Right. So, but understanding you were down to 5% within Lehman, what kind of, you know, pain have you guys experienced? You had mentioned earlier that you were spending more than a fair amount of time talking to your investors about what you guys did and didn't do.
The reason you don't hear me clapping is because I've lost an arm. I'm kidding. That's a joke for the sake. And I apologize if I've offended anybody. There's not much we can do about it. It's sort of like you get to a point where, you know, we worked really hard in the weeks, the months, and the years after the Lehman failure to recover our client assets.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of, you know, I think we want to be judged ultimately by the things that we did. We didn't quit. We didn't give up. We didn't abdicate our responsibility from a fiduciary standpoint, and we did everything that we could possibly do and are still doing. I mean, Owen is still on the creditors committee to recover our client assets. And, you know, we've set up side pockets and recovery vehicles at some significant expense to us to provide for the return of capital to our investors when it comes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's all we can do. We were there. You know, people will say that we were overly loyal to a firm that was clearly bankrupt. I can tell you, I've been over it time and time again. I think Lehman could have been wound down in an orderly fashion, and probably would have given net equity, by the way, back to the shareholders at the end of the day, I think. Now, the problem was is that their short-term funding guys decided they had enough fun and games, and in that time, you have to put yourself in there. In that time, it was all for one and one for one.
Right.
Nobody was thinking about, everybody was worried about themselves. In the weeks after that, you know, we tried to move significant. I told Goldman Sachs in the Monday or Tuesday after that when they were 50%, they were 50% of our prime brokerage balances post that. 50!
Mm-hmm.
And I called Goldman Sachs. I said, I want to move 10%. I just want to move 10% to Credit Suisse or J.P. Morgan. Okay? And we had accounts already set up at Credit Suisse, and we were just going to move it. You know, I got a call from Goldman Sachs, like, basically saying, we'll remember who our friends are. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, is somebody going to break my knees? Like, when I walk out the front door? Like, what does that mean? We'll remember who our friends are. I mean, that's where we were. We were over the edge. That Goldman Sachs was saying, I'm not moving your assets. And how about this? But Boris Taylor didn't even bother to tell us that we'll remember who our friends are. They just didn't send the money when we asked it for like 3 weeks.
I think just following up on one thing Jeff said, which I think we touched upon a couple of days ago. Again, if Lehman had been wound down in a controlled way, we, and I think lots of other people like us, would have been able to move our positions to other prime brokers very quickly, and, you know, would have been able to continue on without, you know, really any, I don't think, any material damage to us. And I think that would have been the case for a lot of their counterparties. You know, I think there still would have been issues surrounding the more exotic derivatives in terms of being able to potentially move those over, but they would have been, Lehman would have been far simpler, I think, to wind down had that happened.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. If you, the whole fact that, they were able to rehypothecate the securities, if you guys wanted to actually move, does that delay it? The fact that...
Yeah.
It delays it, but again, if it was controlled, there could have been a way for, Lehman to have gotten those securities back from its financing counterparties. What happened here was they went insolvent, so the financing counterparties blew out those securities when they closed out the financing agreements. But if someone was, standing behind in a controlled way, I think Lehman could have gotten those securities back and then had them to deliver back to their clients.
Right, so for example, if you would have called Lehman on September 10th and said, I want to move my prime brokerage account to Goldman, Morgan, Credit Suisse, whoever. Would they have said, well, great, we'll remember who you are. But after that, and they'd say, okay, we'll move it, but since it's all been rehypothecated, you understand it's going to take X number of days.
Nah, you probably wouldn't have walked you through it. It'd been like, all right, tell us what you want to move. It doesn't go, first of all, you don't move the account, you move the positions. You
right.
Never close the account. I mean,
by the way, if this had happened in, 8 months before, and you said that to them, they should be able to do it, and it should settle in probably T+3.
But before they did that, you would have definitely gotten a call from somebody saying, hey, what are you doing?
Right.
So that's why you do it, you do it in increments, so you don't wake anybody up. If you really have a stated objective, like we did to bring our exposure down to Lehman Brothers, you don't do it like, you don't wake up one day and go, whoop. What you do is you kind of,
Do it over time. But by the way, there were people who tried to move their stuff the week before the insolvency. And I think there are a lot of people who then, had securities sort of caught in transit when you had the insolvency filing. And so now that's why you had several hundred thousand. That's one of the reasons you have several hundred thousand failed trades and now need to be reconciled by the various estates.
Mm-hmm. In terms of moving the positions in a prime brokerage account, you had mentioned that you didn't do it towards the end because you didn't want to trigger a run. If you would have, is there any kind of like preference thing like there is in bankruptcy law where, if somebody gets paid something from a company that goes bankrupt within the last 12 months, they can claw it back?
Well, before we answer that question, I want to make sure we're not overstating the run on the bank point, because I think we've kind of gone over a lot of other reasons why we had the kind of assets at Lehman that we had there. So it was kind of more one of several factors, and I don't want to overstate the importance of that point. In terms of whether or not there was this kind of preference idea, I'm not sure. Honestly, I think you have to talk to a bankruptcy lawyer about that. But I'm not sure that concept would apply in a circumstance where you are just moving one of your basically custody assets.
We don't know. The short answer is we don't know.
Yeah, but I don't think we know. I think you'd have to really talk to a bankruptcy lawyer about that.
And all I'm getting at is and I understand. I know I keep asking about it. I don't mean to be overstressing the importance of it. But whether that decision to not move all the positions, was it just a straight altruistic move, or was it, there's some self-interest involved there, too?
No, it's not altruism. If it was altruistic, we wouldn't have moved any positions. We did what we thought was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
It was beyond the pale, given the way that the federal government had acted, particularly the week before with Fannie and Freddie. If they would save Fannie and Freddie, right, meaning save them as entities and take them on balance sheet, and that they wouldn't do something to orderly wind down Lehman. I mean, that's really the issue.
Right.
You can do all the math you want to do. We were doing all the math we did. We didn't think Lehman was insolvent. Let's say that they lose all their funding. Well, then they're just going to put them into administration and conservatorship and wind it down like they did, Drexel. So we're not going to get hung up. We don't want all of our assets hung up in administration. That could take some time. Mm-hmm. But you know what? We're down at 5%. We're probably okay.
So did you have any discussions with your friends at the Fed, you know, after Lehman did declare bankruptcy and say, what the hell were you guys thinking? What about all these dozen phone calls I had with you guys on Saturday and Sunday?
Yeah, lots of them.
Well, what did they say?
I mean, they were probably somewhat at the same pitch that I got to in this call, you know, but probably for an extended period of time.
But what did they say?
I was angry.
And what did they say? Why not do an orderly wind down?
I think everyone was going, well, I don't think that was in our jurisdiction. I mean, I got a lot of that. I was like, well, I don't know. That's not within our powers. So, no, the irony of this whole thing is, to me, you have one thing to say here, right? There has to be a single regulator at the end of the day, in my opinion. And I did give this advice to the Federal Reserve subsequently. One freaking regulator who, at the end of the day, you look at that group or that guy, and he makes the call. Because this was like, well, I don't know, what do you want to do? I don't know, well, what do you want to do? You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, let's get together and talk about what we want to do. Meanwhile, tick, 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 you know. And guys are going, God, this is a really tough decision. Because there were some things that happened, or, you know, at least as I understood them to be, and you can read the books as much as I can, but I talked to a lot of my friends in the prime broker and in Treasury, and they had collateral packages that were ready to go. I mean, Barclays, you know, could easily have done this deal. The Fed and the Treasury refused to guarantee for that 30-day period Barclays so they could get the deal done. That's the other irony of this thing is, I mean, for goodness sake, they had Lehman had more than enough collateral to pledge to the Fed, just like Bear Stearns did, to basically bridge them for 30 days. Yeah, and so, you know, it's the classic, you know, example of, you know, I always try to think about, am I going to end up doing this anyway? Like, that's the question I always ask myself. I actually asked the Fed this. I said this to the guys at the Fed in December of 2007. I was like, look, you should just go to 1% rates now. And they're like, why? I'm like, because you're going to go there anyway. Like, you need to flood the market with liquidity now, and you should go there anyway. Because if you don't make a bold statement that you're on top of this thing, then the market's going to think you're wishy-washy and force you to do it anyhow. So I had this conversation with them again. You should just start buying mortgage securities. Why would we ever do that? Because at the end of the day, there's nobody left to buy mortgage securities, and they need, if you want to sort of, you know, hold the line on mortgage on valuations and mortgages, you're going to have to stand in there and bid for it. Well, so they said no, and then the bank started failing. They bought Fannie and Freddie. I mean, it's sort of another example of, you know, not thinking one or two steps ahead. You know, they could have guaranteed a $30 billion loan for 30 days, and the worst case scenario is they take Lehman Brothers on their balance sheet and do an orderly wind down. That's the worst case scenario. Right? Instead, they say no, because, you know, they got to teach everybody a lesson, or, you know, it's not in their jurisdiction, or whatever the reason is. And then 3 days later, they ask for $700 billion. It's like, and they bail out AIG for $60 billion. I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, this is all happening in like 3 days. Like, who's thinking? Who's actually got the, and I think at the end of the day, one of the things is that there isn't one single place to go where someone says the buck stops here. It's not the Federal Reserve Board. It's not the U.S. Treasury. It's not the SEC. Who is it? And so because there isn't that, when you have these big organizations that are very interconnected and cross every different kind of regulatory boundary and have broad implications, there's nobody in the government that has the authority to stop the music and say, I'm going to own this, and we're going to wind it down. And that's really what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And when you cut away from it all the sideshows and all the, you know, you made that mistake and you made that mistake, nobody owned the trade. In Fannie and Freddie, it was easier because that was not a broker-dealer. The Fed and the Treasury understand mortgage securities really easy. The balance sheets may have been cocked up, but they were relatively straightforward. They could step in and say, I own this, because at the end of the day, they're basically government-sponsored agencies anyway. That's what I missed.
Mm-hmm.
I missed that.
Right.
There was no single regulator that could have stepped in and said, enough is enough. And I think, you know, sadly, you know, this FinReg situation almost makes it worse, because FinReg comes out and they push down the decision tree to a series of regulators, and it doesn't solve the problem. Because we'll be, if God forbid we ever get back there again, you're going to have the same types of people. Maybe you'll have more of them, more groups in the room trying to say, who owns that? Do I own that? Do you own that? Who's responsible? Am I responsible or you responsible? I don't know. It's not on my charter. I got to check my charter. These people at the Fed were literally looking at Fed bylaws and charters to see if they had the authority to do certain things, and they had a really compressed timelines in order to make those decisions. And it's insane to think about that. It's insane to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what was happening at the time. So do I fault these people? I don't. I don't even know who to be mad at. You know, can I be mad at Hank Paulson? I guess, but, you know, maybe he was making his decisions with the best available information. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But if it were me in that position and I had my drug, I would have been like, you know what? I'm going to step up. I own this trade. Here's what we're going to do. Because the pain associated with that thing is too much to bear. And by the way, if we let that happen, we're all going to be scrambling anyway. We're going to be rewriting the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think we lack leadership in this country. That's where I think the regulatory framework of this country lacks leadership. You're not really incented to do that. You know, you're not empowered to do that in the end game, because people are worried about checks and balances. And in this particular time, we needed a dictator. We needed a tyrant.
But it's still hard to reconcile all that with AIE 3 days later.
But there, you know, once the dam breaks, everybody's throwing sandbags, right? Everybody's throwing sandbags. Before the dam breaks, we can talk about what it's like when the dam breaks. We can talk about what it's going to be like and hope it doesn't happen and say, I'm not really the sandbag kind of guy. I'm more like a guy in the back lines who's going to help dry things out when it's over. But when the dam breaks, everybody's up there with sandbags. And there you can get everybody in the room and say, okay, we're going to do this. And nobody's asking the question, do I have the charter? Because you're in the suit. You're swimming. Everybody's swimming. That's what happens. And so to me, that's really what I think, you know, ultimately happens. Hold on 2 seconds, guys. Hang on.
Sure.
So that's, I'm going to have to wrap up here in a few minutes, unfortunately, because I've got so many waiting for me. But to me, you know, again, I'll try to, if you send Owen your emails, or send us your emails, I will send you this book that tries to talk, this 186-page tome that talks about, you know, regulatory reform. It may be a little bit outdated. It's over a year old. But I think if I had one strong message in the midst of all of your, you know, interviews you're going to be doing, I think the strong message is that in times of exigent circumstances, there needs to be a default regulator who has the ability to trump everybody else and get and make calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you get that done, but that's what I would recommend.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time.